To me, to be beautifully broken is embracing the brokenness of life, because we all have it, and knowing that there is purpose in it and that we don't have to just let it break us, but that we can use that brokenness to absolutely change and make the world a better place.
Welcome to the Beautifully Broken Podcast. I'm your host, Freddie Kimmel, and on the show, we explore the survivor's journey. Practitioners making a difference, and the therapeutic treatments and transformational technology that allow the body to heal itself. Witness the inspiration we gain by navigating the human experience with grace, humility, and a healthy dose of mistakes. Because part of being human is being beautifully broken. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Beautifully Broken Podcast. I'm here with a very special guest today. We have Alexandra Marie Hogg. Welcome to the podcast, Alexandra.
Thank you. Thank you.
Going forward, I'm just going to say Alex.
Yes. Yeah. That's totally fine.
So I got to ask to start off. In the beginning, I just want to be sure I'm pronouncing your name right. It's Hogg. But it's Hogg. Yeah. And when I was a kid, Kimmel, like it was Kibble and Bits. Kids are, you know, they always want to make fun of a name if it can be associated with a joke.
Yeah.
Was that ever happen to you in growing up?
Well, no, because I married into this name. So my original name was so hard to pronounce. It was German and very, very long. So nobody could even pronounce it. So I didn't get any name jokes. It was more like, oh, you have big ears, or, you know, those kinds of jokes, since my name wasn't really a good target.
And you couldn't convince your husband to take your last name?
No, I didn't want him to, because it's so long and nobody can ever pronounce it or spell it or anything. We're like Hogg. It's like, you know, people are a little taken aback by it, but it's pretty easy. We live in Arkansas too. So it's like the Razorback Hogs. They don't have a football team. They just have college. So it's like super fitting for where we live.
Beautiful. I love that. And just for fun, how do you pronounce your original name that you grew up with as a child?
Settlemyer.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
That's not that bad.
Yeah. Try spelling it.
I love it. So I became connected with you because I heard your name come up multiple times, once through our friend Jen Ragazzo. Mm-hmm. There was somebody else in business coaching. Mm-hmm. He said, you got to talk to my friend Alex. She's this amazing business coach helping women empower themselves, up level, really make quality income from Facebook groups. And they said, and then Jen said, you also got to talk to Alex because she has an incredible story that would totally fit within this beautifully broken paradigm. So the question is, you know, tell me about a life moment. Tell me about a time in your life that was hard, that was challenging for you. Maybe we can go from there.
Life is hard, right? Like no matter what, no matter the level of success you're at, like there's always challenges. I would say, looking back, for me, one of the hardest moments was being brand new sober. That was probably one of the hardest moments for me in my life, is getting clean.
What did that look like, that time leading up to that? You said getting clean with addiction. Can you frame that a little bit?
Yeah. So I actually, at the age of 12, by a family member, got introduced into cocaine. So I didn't even like start with smoking weed or like ease in. I just like jumped in, both feet in, and, you know, into the world of drugs. And so at about 12, I got very addicted. I come from a line of addicts. I wouldn't say it's like in my blood, but it's kind of in my blood, right? Like it's just what I grew up around and what I saw. And so addiction came very naturally to me. So I started at about 12, and for about 8 years, experienced the struggles with addiction, homelessness, getting expelled from school, being incarcerated, all of those things. So it was a very long journey leading up to the moment of sobriety for me. But when I was using, right, there's something to numb the pain. There was something to kind of take away from the reality that I was dealing with. Or isn't it just like a double-edged sword? You're numbing the pain, but you're causing the pain by using, you know? So for me, getting sober was really hard because it's all I had known from a young age.
Yeah.
And the way that I got sober was not your typical like, oh, I went to an AA meeting. I actually had a super traumatic incident that led me into kind of forced my hand at sobriety. So it was dealing with not only sobriety, something I wasn't used to, right? Especially for so long. And then also dealing with the trauma of how I became sober.
Mm. Can we unpack for a second?
I know that's a lot. That was a lot. I was like, we just went through like a whole bunch.
We went through a lot. I'm trying to remember 12-year-old Freddie.
Yeah.
you know, and I grew up in a family with addiction as well. Mm-hmm. However, at 12 years old, life was pretty easy. Mm-hmm. And I just read a chapter about a book I'm writing. I wrote about growing up in the 80s and 90s. And there was such a big campaign for the war on drugs. Mm-hmm. You know, the very famous commercial of the girl diving into the empty swimming pool. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever imagined they'd want to be a drug addict when they grow up.
Yeah.
Of drugs and HIV, because there were these not crazy, but there were very intense marketing campaigns. I always was very scared of narcotics, drugs, and then as well as like sexually transmitted disease. I laughed in this chapter. I was like, I was full on convinced I had AIDS at like 13 years old because you watch commercials and kids picture it up.
Yeah.
So what set the stage for you at 12 years old to try cocaine?
Nobody's immediate family is perfect typically. And so I grew up just with kind of a not being loved and not feeling like I was wanted, you know, and those types of things. I think there was a lot of just feeling insignificant or like I was a burden. Mm-hmm. And so at the age of 12, my dad actually was an alcoholic. He was an amazing father. Like both my parents, you know, were wonderful, but he was great. Like he functioned really well, was at everything, super involved, but I knew he was an alcoholic and he got sober at the age of 12. And I think in my mind, I was so frustrated because I was like, you've been trying like my whole life to be sober. And all of a sudden, like, you know, you're a Christian and now you're clean. And so I think I got really angry with him. I got really angry with this idea of God and who he was and like, why would he wait so long? That it was when the drugs were presented to me by a different family member, it was like, just go for it. Why not? And I wasn't really a heavy user at the age of 12. I was kind of just lightly using. I don't think I was by any means addicted. I think I started to get addicted to the attention that it brought me, right? Like my friends being like, oh, she's so bad. Like, oh my gosh, she's a bad girl. And I got to hang out with the bad crowd. And I finally had like friends. Like I didn't have friends growing up because I was always kind of just that odd man out. And so I think I finally felt like I had a community and something that really bonded me with them. And so I think I took it and ran with it and really owned that identity as a drug addict.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. I can relate because we want to fit in. It feels good to have a crowd and to have admiration, whatever that thing is at a young age. And then how did that escalate over time?
As you can imagine, doing drugs doesn't usually lead to good situations and like good friends. You're not usually surrounded by like the best of people. So 13 came around and ended up in a bad situation with men who were a lot older adults and at a party. And that led to a traumatic experience. We can all kind of imagine fill in the blanks of what happened. And that I think was like the solidifying moment for me. That was the moment where it just like went really downhill. And then I just started dating not good men. It was almost like we create a story in our minds, right? My story growing up was I'm not loved. I'm not worthy of love. I'm not good enough. I'm not going to be loved. So we search for those things in something. Whether that's drugs, we feel like, okay, there's a constant, like I'm accepted. I have a crowd. I have something, right? And then we reaffirm that story throughout our life. And so it's like, I was looking for men who didn't love me or who would use me or treat me bad. And it's like, this is true. See, I knew this from a young age that this was true, but it's like, we're affirming a story that doesn't need to be true, right? And so it's like, that's what I kind of did throughout that experience of using is, leading up to being an adult, I got, you know, involved in the adult entertainment industry. And it's like, what better way to affirm that lie, you know, of being like, you're not worthy, you're not good enough, you're very surface level, but your heart and your personality, no one could love you for who you are. You know, like that world is very good at creating that story with women involved in that industry.
Did you have people in this experience, we'll call this where like you're building trauma, like I imagine this little tornado just picking up these reaffirming clues. Did you have angels along the way? Did you have people out and say, Alex, just stop for a second. What are you doing?
Yeah, very much so. I think my parents and my sister were a constant in my life. My grandma as well, just praying for me and trying to get me out of that world. My parents one time even went as far as, hey, we're going to go visit your sister. She lived in a different state, packed some stuff, took me out there, dumped me off and left, you know? And it's like, some people are like, oh, what horrible parents. And I'm like, imagine your daughter being 15, being suicidal, attempting suicide multiple times, being an addict and having no idea if you're going to come home and find her dead. That's what my parents lived with on a daily basis, right? Is that fear of coming home if I'd be alive. You would do anything to save your child. It's like they just tried so much. I would say the biggest moment for me would be, speaking of angels, is when I got sober. And then I met my husband. So when I got sober, and this is like warning, you know, of getting, I mean, like we haven't talked about anything traumatic, but this is where it gets really real for me. I was dating a guy. We had an open relationship. We actually lived with one of his girlfriends as well. And we were all in the apartment. He was super, super abusive towards her, but he really didn't put his hands on me too much compared to her. She ended up moving out because she got pregnant and it was not a safe situation for her and the baby. And so it was just me at that point. And he tried to take my life. It was like a 3-day thing. Like it was a very long, drawn out, lots of like torture and mind games and all these things. And when he finally snapped and he's like, you know what, like this is it. Like he was laughing and talking about how he was going to actually kill someone. He couldn't believe it. He had thought about it for so long. He covered his eyes. He's like, I can't see. And he was like feeling around and he kept talking about how he couldn't see anything. And he was like laughing while he's trying to find me. But I knew in that moment, I was like, this is the answer to my parents' prayers. Like this is my angel coming in and saying, it's not your time. That for me was an absolute life-changing moment where I knew there was something more for my life. And I knew I had to make a change because I knew I was like, okay, like you can only, you know, dance with the devil for so long. And so it was a beautiful moment for me to, number one, get out and get to the hospital and call an ambulance. And that was also a very traumatic experience for me where it kind of, again, forced my hand at getting sober because I had really bad PTSD. I still struggle with it after that moment, but it also led me to my husband, who is another angel in my, you know, eyes. He was saving himself for marriage, like on the church worship team. You know what I mean? Like very, very different people, very different people. So meeting him too, I think has been a big piece in my healing and my sobriety and changing the story that had been written in my mind for so long.
Yeah. Talk about opposite ends of the spectrum.
Oh, still to this day, like total opposites.
When did you meet your husband in the process of getting sober or making this shift? As you said, you were in this process of just dancing with the devil. When you're saying that, I'm like, that is some dark shit. That is beyond the WB network. That's like dark Batman.
Yeah, no. And I mean, if you only knew, like if I only went into some of the things that this man was into, like.
I can imagine.
Yeah, like lots of witchcraft. It was weird. Like, I'm like, it should be like a horror movie. Like that time of my life. But so it's a funny story how we met. I moved in with my parents. So I called my parents, was like, I need to get out. I need to get out of this apartment. Like I need to come home. And so we went to the apartment with my parents, police, and cleaned out all my stuff and got out of there. And I went to their house and my mom kept telling me, well, you have to come to church to meet your husband. Your husband is there. Like you've got to come meet this guy. I just know it. He's your husband. And I was like, number one, I'm not stepping foot in a church. And number two, like I don't date white guys. He was white. And I was like, you know, I do not date white guys. Like I'm not interested. I've never dated a white guy. Like it's not going to happen. And so she kept hounding me and hounding me. And finally I was like, okay, if I go, will you like leave me alone? Like if I go, can you just like back off with this whole come meet your husband thing? And she was like, yep, I swear. If you go and you look at him and you don't feel anything, you never have to come back to church. And so I was like, all right. So we walk into this church together 3 months after I had been sober. So I'm still dealing with really severe, severe anxiety. I'm still dealing with severe mental health issues from this situation. And I'm still struggling to stay sober at this point, right? And we walk in and I point to a guy standing in front of us. I go, he has a really nice ass, whoever that is. Like, I'd marry him. She goes, that's him. That's your husband. And so I start laughing and I was like, oh my gosh, like what a coincidence. And he turned around and it was just, I knew, like I told all my friends, I was like, I'm going to marry him. Like that's my husband. And sure enough, it's so funny because it's full circle to me. We started talking on Facebook. So I added him as a friend and we started talking on Facebook. And now it's like, I run this whole Facebook consulting business and like it's full circle, right? So yeah, we actually started talking there and we fell in love pretty fast and pretty hard, and which was odd for him. He was very guarded with women. It took him a while to warm up to me. I scared him. And a lot of his friends told him to stay as far away from me as possible, that I was just going to break his heart. And so he should not have anything to do with me, but he didn't listen to them, thankfully. So here we are 8 years later.
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't know if you meant to phrase it this way, but when you were talking about the experience that was kind of your rock bottom with this guy, mm-hmm. did you refer to him as an angel? Did you mean that?
I mean, I guess in a way, honestly, like he's the one that led me to my husband and to sobriety and to the life that I'm in. I mean, I don't have any ill feelings towards him at all. Like I don't, yeah. I really don't. I believe yeah. that hurt people. And so, you know, to me, it's like, he hurt me for sure. Like I still deal with yeah. the trauma from him yeah. to this day, but he didn't know any better. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, yeah, he's an adult. People can argue with that and be like, yeah, he knows better. But it's like, if you knew this poor man's like childhood and what he experienced as a kid, to me, it's like, he's only acting out of a place of what he knows. And I can only pray for him and hope that he makes changes and that he just finds a better life and that he finds peace. Like, I don't want anything. That's taken me a long time. There were a lot of times I thought, man, I wish I had a concealed carry, you know, or like yeah. a weapon in the house when he was trying to do that. And there was yeah. definitely times where I thought about how I just wanted to hurt him because of what he did to me. But, you know, it's like, you can't live your life with that burden and that hatred. I mean, you know, it's like unforgiveness is like drinking poison. You just can't do that. You can't not forgive people for the things that they've done to you, you know? And I mean, in my opinion, I know it's way easier said than done, but yeah, I'm a big believer in forgiveness, but I think that my angel was whatever blinded him, whatever made it where he couldn't see for long enough for me to get out of the house and to run to a neighbor's apartment and call the police.
It's incredible. And it's a very interesting exercise to play for anybody listening to this. I often will pose the question to clients. It's, you know, imagine that one person, it's like the foil in your ever unfolding story, the person that's hurt you the most. What would it feel like to stand in their presence and embrace them in loving kindness, mm-hmm. you know, send them, give them like the most long embraced hug and try to exude love from your heart center towards mm-hmm. this person? What would that feel like? And it's really interesting, you know, and people do say, you're like, I could do that. I want the best for them. And people are like, never, never. That repels me. That's disgusting. And, you know, there's something to that little mental exercise. It's fascinating because you did say there was an angel in that moment. I didn't know if you meant your parents or your mom or you meant him being the teacher, you know, that lesson that led you out of this.
Yeah, no. And that's the thing is like, I mean, for 8 years, I tried to get sober. It's not like I wasn't trying to get sober. I was trying to clean up. I was trying to get out of it, you know, and it's like, no matter where I went, I found drugs. I found a guy, you know, like it didn't matter where I was. And so I am really thankful for that experience. Prior to this, I was like super wild. Like I was the party girl. Like I was definitely like the life of the party. I was out. I was doing crazy things. Like I was doing things, super illegal things all the time, you know? And like after that situation, I couldn't even like leave my house. It completely changed me. I didn't want anyone in my house. I didn't want to leave my house. I could not leave my house without taking a Xanax. I kind of developed OCD and agoraphobia from that situation. And it's like, I still struggle with it to this day. Like it's gotten a lot easier. Like I'm not, you know, on medications. I can deal with it more. Like I've learned practices and how to center myself. And I've started this journey of self-compassion and learning to love myself. And, you know, it's an ever evolving, I've done EMDR. So I've like worked through some of that trauma and then COVID came into play. So then we had to stop, you know, it's an never ending journey of undoing the habits or the thoughts. And we're always getting better and we're always improving. Right. And it's just like, had I not gone through that experience, I don't know if I'd be sober today. You know, I feel like the anxiety in a way gives me strength to stay away from drugs. Cause it's like, my fear is always being out of control, right? Like not being in control because I was intoxicated when the situation happened. And so it's like, I don't drink, I don't do drugs, I don't touch anything. Like I even struggle taking ibuprofen sometimes, you know, cause I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. And it just triggers anxiety in me. But so it's like, definitely no way I'm gonna go snort anything when I struggle with it. So it's, to me, it is truly, it's finding it to be a blessing as hard as that is, like trying to look at it from a really positive perspective, you know?
It's an incredible story. And I can only imagine the gratitude and just disbelief that your parents must feel from having to just live through that for years and years and years. And finally having this daughter who's on the other side and not only sober, but really and truly thriving with a beautiful family and successful and continuing to do this self-work. What were some of the tools that you found really helped you not only to get sober, but to stay sober? Because I know that's very different for many people.
Yeah. So I actually did attend, it's called Celebrate Recovery. So it's basically a faith-based like AA or NAA meeting. And I went to those for a long time. When I started to feel a little bit of slipping, I would go to those and just kind of remind myself of how far I've come and how not worth it it is. And so surrounding myself with those types of people, you know, definitely obviously cutting off every single person. And that's the thing that's hard is I'm a very caring person. I think that's why I've been so successful in business, right? But like, I'm a very caring person. That's definitely one of my strengths. And so it was so hard to cut off. Even the guy that did this, I like wanted to be his friend and like make sure like he knew I forgave him. And like, I wanted to like, you know, just like stay in touch and catch up and, you know, with all the old friends. And it's like, the second I got around him, I would find myself falling back into talking a certain way or trying to act a certain way. This just is not going to lead to a good place. Like this just is not going to be a good spot for me. So really cutting every single person off, as hard as that was to do, was a huge thing. And just again, surrounding myself with new people, healthy people who inspire me, you know, who just encourage me to be the person I wanted to become. Definitely like for counseling. So I went to therapy like my entire life and I always felt like it was just pointless. Like I was like, this is just the dumbest thing I've ever done. And EMDR therapy was probably the most impactful for me. Definitely like doing some EMDR was like absolutely one of the most healing types of therapy I've been through. And then working with a trauma coach, those have been, for me, when I think of tools, I think of like, what are practical things that I can take from this and implement into my life moving forward, right? And those were definitely those pieces of that puzzle for me.
Yeah, the EMDR had been a really profound discovery for me in the last year. I think like you, I had tried so many therapists and just, I ended up quitting.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just like, I'm done with this person. They don't know shit.
Yeah.
And so the eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy has been really profound. And I was amazed how it would like crack the shell on trauma. And you'd have this, I like to say it was like scrying. It was like screaming and crying. It was like such an emotional release. And then there was less charge after you would do this thing of literally moving your eyes side to side and having a vibration go to your hands. I'm like, how is this doing anything?
Yeah. It's fascinating when you look into the actual science of it, right? And like how powerful it is and like how it helps the brain to break down trauma. But the thing is that's so interesting is I actually went into my EMDR thinking, okay, if I just can heal from this one situation, like I'll be set. I'll be like a totally normal person. I'll be good. And I went in and as we're diving into this, it was like, it led me traumas I had stored so deep down from childhood that I had forgotten about or thought like, oh, that's not really like a trauma. So it's fine. That's what connected the dots for me is like, this situation was just the like cherry on top when you have so much more trauma that built that story up in your whole life. And this was just like the breaking point for you. So it actually led to other things. And for me, it wasn't like a super intense situation. I cried like a baby. That's for sure. Like definitely felt those emotions and those things. And, but again, it was one of the most like, I can't wait for like everything to calm down so I can go back and do it some more because I'm like, it was literally so powerful for me. And led me on this journey of starting to actually see healing for the first time in years of therapy. So I'm like, I'm very excited to go back and do more. And I might get to the scrying stage at some point, you know?
Yeah. It surprised me. I was just like, I didn't know what that was, you know, some of the things I didn't know that was inside.
It's
I was
amazing.
Like, I feel pretty well balanced. Yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah.
You know, they do have these leads that can, I think they can come right off your computer or they hook up to an attachment. You can hold like little buzzers in each hand. You can do, I've done Zoom sessions or even with tapping opposite sides. I could easily say I've had just as powerful discovery and release from Zoom that I have in person,
which
is hard to believe, but it, you know, I think if you have the right therapist, it can be.
I'm like, can we exchange therapists information?
Yes. Like, yeah. Totally. But like, you know, the thing is, you find a good one. And because of our weird little medical system that needs a lot of love and evolution, you know, you can't practice and you can't practice distance or you can't be in Connecticut and help a person in California. And so that's what I've run into is, you know, you're licensed in a state and it can be limiting, but it does work on that online approach.
Yeah.
That was a really cool discovery. Yeah. There's so many good things out there. I think what I would offer to people is if you aren't making progress in sessions, that if you're with a therapist for 8 months, 12 months, 16 months, and you're talking about the same thing mm-hmm. and you're not making progress, go fire that therapist in a nice way
yeah.
and go find somebody that's working for you, because like anything else in the world, there's different levels of competency and success and resonance in all arenas. So you yeah. can find yeah. somebody that really works for you.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, I think too, it's not just finding different therapists. It's finding different therapists with different skill sets, and also asking like, what's the expectation? Like, what's the tools that you use? How do you work with clients? Because I think for me, like, I had worked with so many therapists that I felt like I was broken, right? I was like, mm-hmm. none of them are making progress with me. I must be broken. There's no hope. I can never be fixed, which led to a really like dark suicidal place, right? Because I was like, what's the point if all these professionals can't fix me, you know?
Yeah.
And it was not me. It was the fact that I was not asking the right questions, and I didn't know what to look for. And I just didn't set the expectation going in or ask what the expectation should be. And so I think that's another important piece of when you're looking for someone, it's like, don't just go in and start and be like, well, let's try this out. Because that can lead yes. to, especially if people, you know, have a tight budget or can't afford, you know, they're like, okay, I can only afford like 2 months of it. You don't want them to waste that time, you know? So I would even do like a pre-interview before going in with somebody to make sure they have tools that they can use that might benefit what you're looking to do.
Yeah, that's incredible advice. Let's pivot to your success.
Yeah.
So we're on the other side a little bit. And well, let me go back. Besides the tools that we mentioned already, was there anything integral to you maintaining your sobriety, whether it was exercise or food or meditation or any type of outside of the box modalities that helped?
Yeah. When you're an addict, right? It's like you have to get addicted to something else. To be totally honest, in my opinion, that's what's worked for me. And that's like my dad, his new addiction is sugar. He's been on sugar, which is obviously not the healthiest, but replacing that alcohol, that's what he's always kind of stuck to. And that's, you know, allowed him to stay sober. And, you know, for him, faith has been a big piece mm-hmm. of it. For me, I would definitely say faith has been a huge piece of my sobriety. Just the overwhelming gratitude that I have for, you know, my beliefs and you know, Jesus and God and my religion. And that has definitely been, I think, a critical piece for me. I would not say the church, because the church is just as broken as anything else, right? But just like my own faith, like my Bible, and doing my own mm-hmm. journey of seeking out who is God. Because I grew up with a lot of people saying who God was. I've gotten kicked out of a lot of churches, like as a young kid, and I've seen a lot of unhealthy churches, unfortunately, right? I'm sure we all had that yes. experience with unhealthy Christians or churches. And so for me, it was not necessarily relying on other people to show me who God was, but searching out who God was for myself and going on that journey on my own. That, and then like I kind of mentioned, getting addicted to something else. So for me, my addiction is totally food. And that could sound bad. Some people are like, oh, addiction to food is so bad. But I'm like, it can actually be really fun. Like you can make it, it doesn't have to be a bad thing. Like I love trying out new recipes. Yeah. I love, you know, like for me, I have like a healthy lunch that I eat every single day. I know that I'm going to eat that lunch every single day. And I know like, I'm going to drink my electrolytes. And like, it's a habit for me that I get addicted to. So I definitely think having like a schedule and routine for me has been something that's allowed me to continue to stay sober, and kind of replacing that addiction with something else that's a healthier option, right? Food's more healthy than Coke, if we're being honest. Mm-hmm. And so just like kind of having another outlet for me of that consistency in a different way.
It's beautiful. Yeah. So as we move to your, you know, other side of the story, as I said before, I heard about you because you were such an amazing business coach. Now, from my understanding, now you started as in sales, correct? And you found some mm-hmm. success there. Yeah. I've heard you mention that before. Can you elaborate on that experience a little bit?
So to give you kind of some context, my husband and I got married. I couldn't hold a job because of my anxiety. So like I'd show up to work and I would freak out and I would leave because I just would be so nervous being around people. And so I kept trying to get a job and I couldn't keep a job. So I just ended up staying home and playing Xbox was what I did. And then I ended up getting pregnant about 10 months in. It was not planned. We were not trying, but I was like, perfect. Now I'll be a stay-at-home mom. Like now I have a reason to be at home and not deal with guilt. I mean, like I should be doing more. So I got pregnant, had our first daughter, got pregnant 3 months after I had my first one. And so pregnant again, had a second one. And then we were like, we're putting the stop on this. We're done. Because we had two girls. And I was like, Lord help us. They're going to be like 12 and 13 at the same time. Like, we're going to have to walk through a lot of hormones and all those things. So we ended up deciding we were done at that moment. So I just was like, I'm going to be a stay-at-home mom. Like, I love this. This gives me purpose, makes me, you know, it fills that void that I had of being able to love them. And then it was kind of like moving on. I started to get lost in that identity of being a mom, right? Mm. Like, there's that, oh, all I do is change diapers. Like, now I have no purpose besides, you know, taking care of kids. And it's kind of same story, just different situation. Mm-hmm. So I ended up getting a job as a waitress. And I was like, yeah, we'll see if this works. Like, it was kind of a fly by the seat of my pants. I just was like, I'm going to go interview and see if I can get this job. It was a little family owned restaurant that was opening. And I was like, it's close to the house. Kind of makes me feel safe because I feel like I can run home if I need to. And I got the job and I actually fell in love with it. I definitely had panic attacks at work being around people and feeling like I was trapped there. But through the years, I ended up just falling in love with the job. And they kept trying to get me to be like the head waitress and move into management because I was that server that would get tipped like $100 on a $30 bill. Like, I just had such a good relationship with people coming in and like I loved giving them this amazing experience. So it kind of started to develop that sales personality. Yes. Where I was always like trying to upsell them and get them to add on things, you know, make their bill bigger and all of this recommending stuff and knowing the menu really well. And so I came by it really naturally. And I kind of say that it's, you know, it kind of came from being like, you know, in the adult industry and being a drug dealer. It's like, you're very aware of people. You're very aware of other people. You start to really learn people's personalities. It's almost like you're learning sales, totally. Right? So it's like I learned sales at a younger age, just in a kind of toxic way. But so it's like, it just came really naturally for me. And then my husband was at a job that he was just really miserable at. We're talking like conservative, Southern boy. And then the place he worked at believes that the earth was flat and like that Donald Trump was like an alien and that reptilians guarded the center of the world. Huh. And I mean, like very, very out there beliefs. Like everybody had to charge themselves in this like massive $60,000 crystal they bought before they came into the office. Like,
wow.
And there's pieces of what they taught that I like kind of believe.
Crystals do have power, scientifically proven.
Yeah, like I believe that. But the whole like, you know, center of the world, I'm like, how do you have a center of the world if the earth is flat? Like there was just a lot of things I was real confused about with their beliefs, but he didn't really fit in. I mean, they took really good care of him. They paid him well, but we went to the Christmas party and this was in 2016 for the Christmas party. And they were like doing Coke off of tables and like hotboxing these super expensive hotel rooms. And we weren't participating. And we kind of got crap for it. Mm. And then we ended up leaving early. Well, a girl tried to give my husband a lap dance and he was like, you're going to see the old like ghetto version of my wife come out and it's not going to be pretty. So like, he's like, we got to go. He's like, I don't want you to like beat this girl up. So we ended up leaving. And the next day his boss called him and told him that they were talking about firing him after he left because he just didn't fit in with the crowd and he was different than everyone else. And so she's like, I'm just giving you a heads up. They're going to start looking to replace you. And so that was a moment for me where I'm like, I have to do something. Like, I don't want to stay here where we were. I was like, I've got to do something. Like, I just got to do something. So I always hated network marketing. I always was like, it's a pyramid scheme. Like, I'm not interested. Yeah. And somebody came to me with a product and it was awesome. And I was like, I could sell the crap out of this. Like, this would be so easy for me to sell. And so I signed up and it was really interesting. I mean, I had like 140 friends on Facebook and like half of them were family.
Yeah.
You know, my husband, his side of the family, like his mom has like 8 brothers and sisters. So it's like, they have this huge, massive family, right? So I'm like, it was honestly mostly family. And so I started this and I created a Facebook group because that's what they told me to do. And I, you know, added a few friends and asked them if I could add them and started just working the business. And I left my job within a month, which wasn't a huge deal. I mean, I was waitressing, mm-hmm. you know, I was able to retire my husband in about 3 months. And so I'd replaced his income and we decided to move across the United States. So we went from Colorado to Arkansas. We had always wanted to live here. We kind of wanted a fresh start just away from, I mean, I grew up in Colorado. So it's like everybody I knew was there, all my ex-boyfriends, like we're building a house and one of my exes was the guy building it. And I was like, yeah, no, that's we weird. Can't do that. Like he's going to put a camera in the bathroom or something. Like, you know, I didn't date some really like mentally stable guys. So I was like, you know, this just isn't really what I want. So we ended up moving, and it was this just kind of beautiful experience. Within about 6 months of being with that company, I was in the top 30 out of 250,000 women for sales and recruiting. And then I started a product-based business that targeted network marketers and kind of just used same methods that I used in my other business. And we grew a group to about 18,000 members in 3 days. In the first 6 weeks, we sold like almost $200,000. And like our first year in that business, we sold $347,000 in product. Yeah. So just like took off. Baller. Well, then the issue is the company that I was with, there was always comments from the women. Cause you know, when you're in the top of the company, you attend all the private events, you get all the private dinners, and you get to be around corporate, and you get to be around all the top girls. And there's just so many things that didn't align with me. Like, number one, there was racism, and like, I just am not down with that. Number two, I would get a lot of comments of like, you just don't look like you fit in. Cause it was a cosmetic company. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm covered in tattoos.
Can we say what the company was, or no, we don't want to do that?
It was Synagence. So it was like the bulletproof lipstick. Now the thing is like, I literally still use their products. I love supporting my friends who sell it. But for me, it was just not like a good fit being at the top. I always joke, like I'm a rebel. All of my brand is like rebel, right? And I was always getting in trouble.
Yeah.
Being at the top of that company, because it was like, you know, somebody told me I didn't look like I fit in, and I would call them out on it. I'd be like, do you really think that's like the nicest thing to say to someone? Like, does that make you feel better? Like, what is the purpose of saying that to somebody? Like, you know, I didn't just like sit back and be like, oh, okay. Like, I just would ask them questions. Like, you should think about what comes out of your mouth, you know, before you say it to someone. Cause it's like, if it's not to me, it might be to someone else who maybe is on the verge of suicide. You know what I mean? Or like maybe is really struggling with mental health or really struggling with loving themselves. Yeah. And they're not going to say anything, right? And I'm like, no. Like, you don't treat people this way. This is just not okay. So me speaking up didn't go over well, but it's like, I'm not going to hold my tongue with this. And then we had that. I was always in trouble with corporate because of my product-based business. We were targeting Synagence distributors. So we were targeting the women that were selling, and being at the level I was at, it's like, you can't do that. That they have rules in place. Mm-hmm. And so I would get a lot of crap from corporate. They would make comments to me, or, you know, tell me what they thought of it. And so it's like, you know what, screw you guys, I'm out. Yeah. So I just quit. I made sure my girls were taken care of. I made sure my team was taken care of. I made sure that they had resources. I still trained them even after I quit to make sure they weren't just like abandoned. Mm-hmm. Cause I wanted to support them, right? Like, it wasn't them, it was some other reasons. And so I ended up just stepping down from it. And a lot of people came to me and asked, like, how have you done this? Like, how do you have this magic touch with Facebook and building businesses organically? And so I was like, well, I'll figure out how to be a coach. So I invested into some programs to learn how to coach people and what does that look like. And then I started moving into the coaching industry. We started it in 2018. In 2020, we just surpassed $200,000. So it's like, we've been really blessed to see pretty consistent growth out of that business as well. Mm-hmm.
That's incredible. So inspiring.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a beautiful, beautiful blessing.
It's like Cinderella, but with drugs and porn.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I mean, we might as well just call it that, Pornerella, you know?
I love it. Oh my God, that's so inspiring. You know, MLMs, let's talk MLMs for a second, because I had no experience with MLMs. Excited, you know what? Strike that. I tried some essential oils one time and I was like, I'm going to add essential oils to my coaching business. And it was such a horrible experience. It was just so culty. I was like, you know, I just had a really bad taste in my mouth, and there was just like all these rules and restrictions. And I'm like, I can't speak to these the way I want. You know, there's this weird, they want to like keep you like a buy-in. It's like the golden handcuffs to make money. It just felt bad.
Yeah.
So my experience has always been to date that, you know, the driver is people selling their product and not necessarily the quality of what is being marketed. However, I have just come into contact, and it's so funny we're talking about this, with this new product. It's called X39. Mm-hmm. It's a patch. It's a stem cell activation patch that activates the body's own stem cells, which start to deplete 30, 40, 60. They're gone. Mm-hmm. So I've been giving people this product and I don't sell it. I'm just like, here, try 3 days. And they're like, slept the best I've ever slept. Some people, they're like, I can walk now. Couldn't barely stand up without a walker. I mean, and it's a sticker and it's $3 a day. I was like, this thing's going to change the world. So I don't do anything aside from like, oh yeah, you want to try it? Try it. It's money back entry. You know, I mean, in 4 months, it's just growing and you're helping people and it's nice. There's no pressure. There's no team building. It's like very sweet. And the woman, Onyx, her name's Onyx Cole. She ran a company called, I think it was Mona V. It was like the juice. Do you remember that? The purple juice. It was like the acai berry. She reframed it. She goes, network marketing is about relationships and talking to people. It's a contact sport. Like if you like people and you like communicating with other human beings and you got a cool thing, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's totally changed my perception around this.
The thing that's so interesting is everybody wants to be an influencer, right? Like everybody wants to just like post something and get paid to post it. You know what I mean? Or have free products shipped to them. Or like, you know, it's like we share stuff and all the time. But the difference, right, with network marketing is people's experience. And I think about the church with this, right? Like, I'm like, I have been to so many bad churches, but if I just put a label on churches, I think we hold churches to a different expectation, right? Because it's like, oh, they're Christians. They're supposed to be better people. And it's like, why do you think they're Christians? Because they're jacked up and they need help. Like, why would you expect them to be perfect people, right? And then it's like network marketing. We have this expectation of like, oh, they have to be a certain way. And then I do think though, there is a culture within network marketing where it's like sell to every single one of your friends or send cold messages or like do these things. So we have like this negative taste in our mouth about it. When really there's a lot of network marketers out there who don't do business that way. It's just, we kind of shut them out immediately without giving them a chance. But it's, I don't know, to me, it's always like, if I find someone that I like and they're selling a product that I like, I'm super happy to support their business over Amazon or Walmart.
Totally.
I'm super happy to do that. But it's finding those people who have like a quality product. There are a lot of crappy products in the network marketing industry.
So many.
Yeah. But there are some really good ones as well.
Yeah. This company has invested like millions into double blind placebo studies. Like it, I mean, I give it to skeptics and I'm like, no risk, just try it. And I've not had a person call me and be like, yeah, nothing. Hasn't happened. So it's really, really interesting to me. Yeah, I'm fascinated by it and how my opinions changed very quickly. And you know what else really resonates with me is like we're in this time of, God, look at our country, right? Look at the world, right?
Yeah.
Our economy, well, everybody's like, hey, the stock market is actually pretty good. You know, everything's good. I'm like, no. There will be repercussions that aren't presenting themselves at this moment from what we just went through in 2019. And for me, I'm so aware, like, so I come from a Broadway background, right? Mm-hmm. I was in New York 18 years singing and dancing, and every single friend I have has lost their health insurance, lost their coverage. They haven't been paid for over a year. Absolutely no financial assistance for this community of artists, which we all celebrate, and there's just nothing for them. And I'm aware of that. I'm aware of where a lot of people are. I feel at my heart, like that vibration right now. So what's really compelling is that someone could have financial freedom doing something they love, not all day, every day, but a lot of these companies, because if you do build correctly and you take the time to learn what it is, that there's a financial vitality, there's purpose associated. And this is a business in a box. It's a startup, you know, and the only one that is determinant of your success is you. Mm-hmm. So is a someone who's been a performer and it's like, I'm selling me in the room. I got to do my song. I got to do my sides. I'm the one. If I don't book the audition, it's me. It's the same. It's so similar.
Yeah.
So I always think like, you know, if you have the right product, it would be a great fit.
And that was the thing for me with LipSense. It was like with that. So LipSense is one of their like flagship products with Synagence. It's literally lipstick. Like you can knock it off. Like they have a remover, but like good luck getting that stuff off once it's on. Like you, it's basically like you just took a Sharpie to your face. And that's where I was like, I could sell this. Women would go wild for this. Like, and this was back in 2017. So it's like before like Maybelline and all these other companies came out with imitations.
Yeah.
It was crazy. Like just how obsessed, like everyone was with the product, and it was just starting to become really big. So it's like people were posting about it in magazines. And so it was just like perfect timing for me to jump in and have that personality and sell. But it's like, even now I do private coaching and I have programs and I work with different clients, and I have clients in network marketing. I have coaches who like our I coach other women in like service-based businesses. So they're like business coaches or financial coaches or accountants or anybody who's kind of in the service-based industry who's looking to use Facebook to grow. And with my network marketing clients and my service-based clients, everyone who had a business at home or started one from home in 2020 had the biggest year financially that they've like ever had.
I'm sure.
I had a client who we were working together, went from $16,000 a month to over $50,000 a month.
Wow.
During COVID. I was like, you know, I'm like, it's all because of me. No, a part of it was definitely COVID, right? Like it's a good combination, perfect storm, but it's like, what an amazing experience to be able to be making $50,000 a month. You know what I mean? And when there's so many people out there struggling and it's like, this is a beautiful opportunity for anyone. Anyone can start it.
Yeah. Yeah. I always think that I had so many years, you know, I keep all my taxes. My dad was like, never throw away your taxes.
Yeah. We're the
same. So I have taxes from 1995, 1994, actually, maybe like 93, but sometimes I'll go back and look. And I had years, no, so that was not a lot of money as a kid, whatever. I'm like filing my first round of taxes, but I would file oftentimes, you know, you have a great year in New York, you make $100,000 and then you make 20, you make 19 as a performer. It's very much like peak and trough, peak and trough, peak and trough. Whenever I hear the entrepreneur, oh, 50K a month, you know, six figure, seven figure. It's always what the scope is just incredible what people actually do in these.
Yeah. It's like, we just are not used to that, right? Like we're like, if somebody told me that like one of my businesses, we did six figures in 6 weeks. Right. And it's like, had somebody told me that was possible, like I would have died laughing. Like I would have bet $1,000 against them. You know what I mean? Like, I'm like, there's no way. But now it's like, you know, what we become, like what's normal for us. For me, it's normal to hang out with people who are making 30 to 50,000 a month. Like that's not a weird thing. Like it's almost weird now if somebody's like, oh, I'm making $1,000 a month. I'm like, can I help you? Like what's going on? Why aren't you making more? Like it's weirder for me to see people not making money. Now, if we went into like, I'm making seven figures a month, that's where I'm like, I can't wrap my mind around that. That's like beyond my... I know people doing that, but I still am like, I don't even understand how that's possible, you know? So it's like, you kind of, as you level up and you change and your business grows, there's like a new normal that comes into play for you.
Yeah. It's so weird. It's so weird to think about that. And that just like the disparity across the map. It feels like we're growing. It feels like they're more at the bottom, more at the top, and not so many people in the middle. Mm-hmm. And everybody can't be an entrepreneur. The world goes around because we all invest in these different tasks. And and my dad, it's funny, my dad was an engineer and HVAC, like design and build all these, you know, metal products. And it was, I remember him saying, and there was a time when you would go down to the Union Hall and you would hire a trade worker. And it's not something that people are going into now. People don't want to do physical back-breaking labor for good reason. So there is interesting to watch this shift happening across the board.
Yeah.
I want to be respectful of our hour. We're like almost at an hour. We talked for an hour. Your story is so fascinating. I'm so honored to have you on the podcast. I just think it's, you know, you're the real deal. You're the real deal. And correct me if I'm wrong, you do target your service towards empowering women.
Yeah. So like a big part of our business is we like to really focus on empowering those women that don't really believe in themselves or that really kind of just know that there's a purpose for their life and they are trying to figure that out. That's who I love working with because I love seeing that light bulb go off when they start to succeed. And like a lot, like every time we send out gifts, we try to purchase from companies that support those coming out of sex trafficking. Our whole business, doesn't matter how much money we make, we really don't take a lot of money from the company for like paycheck and living. We're trying to save up our money to build a transitional home for women coming out of domestic violence or sex trafficking. And we're trying to do that locally. So we have like a lot, we've already purchased a lot that we want to build it on, but we're looking to, you know, in the next year or two to start actually breaking ground on that home and building that out and being able to provide the counselors and the resources that they need to kind of get on their feet and transition from that into a more stable situation.
Incredible.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I have so many ideas for that facility. Oh my God, we could talk forever. You know, back to the money piece, you know, the mold, the chronic Lyme disease, the chronic fatigue syndrome world, which having gone through that, money is such a funny relationship in that community. There's so many people that have spent $300,000-$400,000, their life savings, they're in debt, trying to get well because the path isn't always that clear. You know, through an advocate of transformational technology, I kind of I niche down and I've identified like these four or five things that, you know, we can do a session on the AMP coil using pulse electromagnetic field and frequency bioresonance. And you can look at that person's heart rate variability, their measurement of the tone between the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system. And you can see these people jump like 20-30%. So left and right hemisphere of the brain, they're talking better. We can put them in front of like a full body red light and we can see a drop in inflammation. We can see oxygenation of the tissue, microcirculation. We can put someone in a detox foot bath. We can see their metals drop, glyphosate, environmental toxins. So all of a sudden, this container that's struggling with the trauma has better energy and resources to recover. I've always thought there is a biohacking biology and addiction gap that we have not connected yet.
100%. That's the thing too, is like, for me, you know, I've dealt with these health issues and I've always thought, oh, it's because of trauma. And then recently I've discovered, oh, it's actually because my house has some mold in it. And oh, like I have some serious inflammation issues that I need to be working on. Like there's so much more to it than just, oh, let's get counselors in, right? Like there's so much more. So we might have to have you come out and help us set it all up, take you out to Arkansas.
I would jump at that consultation. I would jump at that. I have a friend who's been on the podcast a couple of times, Laura McCowan. She has a book on sobriety, Curious Adventures of a Sober Life. But I've always thought in that world too, it's like, get the brain communicating with the organs and organ systems. You are going to hold that decision-making to be sober. You're going to resonate towards joy. You're going to sleep better. We know the body's rebuilding, all these things that we don't necessarily think about in a treatment center or detox facility. You know, what if we really held that person? Let's make you feel amazing. That's incredible that that's a mission for you. And that's going to be local. Are you going to focus on people that are transitioning locally, or do you envision this being a destination for people across the states?
I would like it to be a destination, because the thing is that's hard is when you're doing it in the same place and you go back to the same environment, it's really hard to make a change. So my big dream is to have 50 of them, one in every single state, you know, and really grow this and kind of make it where anyone can access it and get, you know, get to these the houses. Because a lot of times when people leave domestic violence or trafficking, it's like a help me crisis, like make sure I'm safe first.
Yes.
So I would want to keep them in that state, right? Because it's like, you don't want their abuser to be able to come, or the person that's, you know, trafficking them, you don't want them to be able to come and get them. So it's like, it would almost be like a hub that we would then transport them out to a different place where they can have that safety and kind of that security, you know?
Yeah, that's beautiful. Bravo. You're an amazing human being, but you're a perfect fit for the podcast. I can't wait. We'll do another one. Yeah. I think there's a lot of value. We could do just an episode on money and the relationship with money. And
oh my gosh.
We'll close it down. I'm going to give you, Alex, you have a magic wand. You can gift something to the world right now after going through the pandemic 2020. You can gift this to the human race. What would your gift be?
If I had no limits and I could give one gift, it would be to give like every single person a hug, like just a hug and a meal, and invite them into my home and just like love on them. You know, people, it's like 2020, we're not around people. We're secluded. Everybody's scared of everybody. Cause it's like, oh, you coughed. Do you have the COVID, you know? And it's like, just to be able to connect and love on people and just give them a meal, not make them, they don't have to worry about food. You know, that would be just, if I could do that to every single person, I would totally do that.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And we'll do one more question for fun. What does it mean to you to be beautifully broken?
I actually have a tattoo on my side that says, I've seen the beauty in a good tragedy. And to me, to be beautifully broken is embracing the brokenness of life, because we all have it, and knowing that there is purpose in it and that we don't have to just let it break us, but that we can use that brokenness to absolutely change and make the world a better place.
Incredible. We are going to end it there. Alex, it, like I said, absolutely my treat and one of my faves. We should definitely do it again.
Yes. Yeah.
We can get granular and do another one. And I can't wait your tribe to hear your incredible, incredible story told in this beautiful way.
Awesome.
Thank you for being a guest.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Namaste. Ladies and gentlemen, you made it to the end of the podcast, and here we are at season 2. I think this is the beginning of something really beautiful. So one way to support the podcast is to head over to freddysaidgo.com and check out Freddy's Faves, where I've linked every 5-star product and healing modality you hear about on the show. Most offer significant discounts by clicking the link or using the discount code. Please know they don't cost you anything extra, and at the same time, they support the podcast through affiliations. So check out Freddy's Faves on freddysaidgo.com. My heart honestly thanks you for tuning in. And if you've enjoyed today's show, head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. It gives us the virtual thumbs up that we're doing things right. If you want to connect with me directly, I'm on Instagram at freddysaidgo or freddysaidgo.com through email. Now, this is a message from my vast legal team of internet lawyers. The information on this podcast is for educational purposes only. By listening, you agree not to use the information found here as medical advice to treat any medical condition in yourself or others. Always consult your physician for any medical issues that you might be having. That's it for today. Our closing, the world is hurting. We need you at your very best. So take the steps today to always be upgrading. Remember, while life is pain, putting the fractured pieces back together is a beautiful process. I love you.